My response to that is, does anyone from Hawaii have a birth certificate from Hawaii? All right, well, that was a fantastic talk, and it's tough to follow that. Can you hear me okay? Is the mic working? Okay. I realized that when I made the title of this talk, I really missed out on an opportunity to make a joke, a Utah joke. And really, the title of this talk should be, oh my heck, not what the heck. Okay. So we're going to have a case-based approach. Are we doing okay on the mic? Okay. All right, so these are my disclosures. Using a case-based approach today, we're going to develop an approach to some to the diagnosis of some common and maybe not so common acid-base and electrolyte disorders, and then hopefully you'll have a mechanism by which you can utilize this in your clinical practice. So I have about 6 cases to go through, and depending on time, maybe we'll go through a few more. Some of these are pretty challenging, and so don't feel inept if you don't get these right. Some of these are some very unusual cases.
Your lav is not working. Would you like to switch it out? Or would you like to use the podium?
I'll use the podium. That sounds better, yeah. Okay. Let me turn this off. Okay. All right, so let's start with maybe an easy case. This is one that came from our university, and we get these calls all the time. Hey, we admitted a 24-year-old woman with generalized weakness. Her K was undetectable, bicarb was low, and urine pH was high. We think she has an RTA. Can you see her? Thanks a lot. See you later. Our problem. Okay. So here we go. I hope you're familiar with this notation, but the sodium is 141. Potassium, undetectable, less than 1.6. Chloride, 112. Bicarb, 16. BUN14, creatinine, 0.8. And glucose is 103. Do you agree with their diagnosis? Okay. So they mentioned RTA, so let's briefly review what RTAs are. Essentially, they're disorders when the kidney can't get rid of a proton, can't get rid of acid. And that is the underlying problem. There are basically 3 main types of RTAs, type 1, type 2, and type 4. The mechanism for type 1 RTA is a distal problem, so late in the nephron segment, and that's impaired distal proton secretion. Okay? That condition, you have a normal amount of bicarbonate excretion, which is generally very low. Because you cannot secrete a distal proton, your urine pH is high, your urine anion gap is positive, and the plasma potassium is usually decreased, but it can be normal. In fact, the potassium is a big clue here, okay? Type 2 RTA is due to wasting of bicarbonate in the proximal tubular segment. Obviously, if you're wasting bicarb, your urinary bicarbonate excretion will be increased, but maybe contrary to what you might expect, the pH is actually quite low in this condition, because by the time you have depleted all the bicarb in your body and your serum bicarb is normal, the kidney can actually reabsorb most of what is filtered more distally. Anyhow, the pH in the urine tends to be low. Again, urine anion gap is positive, and the plasma potassium is either normal or decreased. The last one is called a type 4 RTA. A better way to remember this one is to change the name from type 4 RTA to hypoaldosteronism, okay? And really what happens here is you have a high potassium level that results from this low aldo state, and that hyperkalemia really impairs ammonia production and other segments, and other ammonia handling segments in the kidney. Urine bicarbonate excretion is normal, pH tends to be low in the urine, and again, the urine anion gap is positive. And because you have a hypoaldo state, you have a high serum potassium, okay? What unifies all of these is this thing called the urine anion gap. So let's start with that, okay? So what is the urine anion gap? Basically, the urine anion gap is a poor man's assessment of how well the kidneys are making ammonium, okay? The only time that you should be measuring it is when you have a patient with a normal anion gap metabolic acidosis, okay? The calculation is very easy. All you do is measure a sodium, potassium, and chloride in the urine, and you do simple subtraction, okay? So what is the rationale behind this? In metabolic acidosis, if the kidneys are working well, they're doing the right thing, they should be making tons of ammonium. Ammonium is important because it grabs onto one of these protons and pees it out. And that's how you get rid of the acid, okay? One of the mechanisms by which you get excrete acid, okay? So going back, if you have metabolic acidosis, your kidneys should be excreting lots of ammonium. That ammonium will bind to chloride. And when you look at this formula, if you have a lot of ammonium, you will also have a lot of chloride, and the chloride will outweigh the positive charges that are in the urine, okay? If your kidneys are not working well, such as if you have a renal tubular acidosis, you have low urinary ammonium chloride, so you have a low chloride in relation to the sodium and potassium, and so you have a positive urine anion gap. That's essentially what you're looking for. Is the urine anion gap positive or is it negative? If your non-anion gap acidosis is due to something like diarrhea, your kidneys will make tons of ammonium because the kidneys are doing the right thing, hence your urine anion gap is negative. Okay? We clear so far? Okay. All right, so let's go back to our patient. Blood pressure, not bad, 115 over 52, okay? And I put that here because you might be thinking, well, if somebody has hypokalemia, maybe they have hyperaldosteronism, in which case they might have hypertension, but this patient did not have hypertension. So hyperaldo is essentially lower on the differential diagnosis. She has generalized weakness and she's hypotonic. So we notice that she has a low plasma potassium and she has a low plasma bicarbonate. The next thing to do in this setting is to calculate the anion gap, and you do this by adding up the two negative charges, chloride and bicarb, and subtract that from the sodium. Here, her anion gap is about 13, which is normal, okay? The other thing to make sure of when you have a patient like this is to also get a blood gas to ensure that you really are dealing with metabolic acidosis. I will say with bicarbs this low, it is almost entirely the case that these patients will have a metabolic acidosis, okay? But I think it's still a good practice to get in the habit of getting a blood gas. So here's her blood gas. Her pH is actually normal. Her PCO2 is 29. Her bicarb is 18 here. And remember, this is calculated, so you should always use the serum bicarb when making your assessments. And you might say, well, her pH is normal, so does she really have a metabolic acidosis? And in my mind, yes, she does, because she does have a low bicarb and she has a negative base excess. Okay? So let's just move on and assume that this really is a metabolic acidosis. Okay? So what are her two problems? Number one, she has profound hypokalemia, right? Undetectable plasma potassium. Second, she has a normal anion gap metabolic acidosis. She also fits a type 1 RTA because she has a high urine pH. But the thing that's really weird about this case is that her potassium is really, really low. So how can we assess that further? One way is by doing this test called a transtubular potassium gradient. And if you haven't heard of it, it's very similar in concept to something called the fractional excretion of sodium, which you will commonly do in a patient who are you are working up for acute kidney injury, okay? And so the TTKG is very similar in its performance to a FeNA, but the thing that you will do differently is instead of using creatinines, you have to use osmolality. So you have to get a plasma potassium and plasma osmolality, sorry, that's on the bottom, as well as a urine potassium and a urine osmolality. Once you get those things back from the lab, and remember, you can't order a TTKG, you have to tell the lab, I want plasma, potassium, and osmolality. If you call them and say, give me a TTKG, they're not gonna know what the heck you're talking about. So you have to remember to order these things individually, okay? So once you get these back from the lab, you plug it in, okay, and we're not gonna go through the math here, so I'll just give you the result. The result here is 2.3, okay? So what does that mean, all right? Well, I'll give you two hints here. One, when you have a ratio from this formula or a result from this formula that is less than 3, that tells you that the kidney's holding on to potassium in the setting of hypokalemia. In the setting of hypokalemia, if you have a result that's more than 3, that suggests that the kidney is getting rid of potassium inappropriately, right? If you are hypokalemic, the kidney should be holding on to as much potassium as possible, and you want this number to be as low as possible, and a cutoff is less than 3, okay? Another clue is if you have a random potassium concentration that's less than 20, that also suggests renal retention. So these two values here suggest that the patient is actually holding on to as much potassium as possible and that the kidney is doing the right thing. Okay? Another thing that you can do is have a patient do a 24-hour urine collection for a potassium. That's perhaps more problematic in the outpatient setting, but can certainly be done in the inpatient setting. And a good cutoff here is if you have more than 25 milliequivalents per day of potassium in the urine, you're losing potassium. Here, her result was less than that, again, suggesting that her kidneys are trying to hold on to potassium. Okay? All right. So, all of the evidence so far has shown that the patient is probably holding on to as much potassium, at least in terms of the kidney, and there is non-renal potassium loss. All right? So, next, let's talk about the normal anion gap metabolic acidosis, okay? So the test to do in this setting is to check a urinary anion gap. You take the positives and the one negative, and you add those all up. And since her chloride is more than the sum of these two, the urinary anion gap is negative. That tells us that there is a non-renal cause of acidosis, okay? So what is the diagnosis here? Is it RTA? Is it hypokalemic periodic paralysis, or is it laxative abuse? I heard it. Very good. All right, laxative abuse. Very good. All right. So just to sum up this case real quickly, in the setting of hypokalemia, I think the most important thing you want to find out, if you don't know what the cause is to determine if the kidney is the problem. And you can do these three things to determine if there is potassium wasting in the kidney. You can do a 24-hour urine potassium, and if it's more than 25, that suggests urinary potassium wasting. If your TTKG is more than 3, or you can use a spot ratio here as well. Potassium to creatinine more than 22, you just have to pay attention to the units here. Here it's milliequivalents per gram of creatinine, okay? All right, so that was a nice warm-up, okay? All right, so let's talk about another case that's very similar. Hey, we admitted a 42-year-old woman with DKA, okay? Important here is that she has DKA. Her potassium was undetectable, bicarb was low, and urine pH was high. Sounds very similar, right? Her DKA is now resolved, but her K and bicarb remain low. We think she has an RTA. Can you see her? Thanks a lot. Get that all the time. Okay, so here we go, 143, now her potassium's 2.9. Again, this is a different case. Chloride 122, bicarb 10, okay? Anion gap is 32.9, okay? So normal anion gap. Kidney function tests are normal, glucose is up. Do you agree with their diagnosis? All right, so problem number one, hypokalemia. I think we'll talk about that first. And just to reiterate the importance of getting a blood gas, but instead of putting you through that exercise, I'm going to tell you that she had multiple blood gases that did show a primary metabolic acidosis. She had multiple urine pHs, which showed a pH more than 6.5 on 3 occasions. Okay. And then she also has a normal anion gap metabolic acidosis. All right. So now we get a TTKG in this patient, and it's 12.5. Okay, so that's much higher than 3, suggesting potassium wasting by the kidney. And if you remember, this is 43. And if you remember from the earlier slide, I said that if you had a random concentration that was less than 20, that suggests renal retention. This is obviously higher, suggesting renal potassium loss. Okay, and again, her 24-hour urine potassium was high, 118. Okay. All right. Now, all of this points to renal potassium loss so far. So let's talk about her normal anion gap metabolic acidosis. And again, you want to do a urinary anion gap. And here you add up these two positive charges, and they're clearly greater than the chloride. So your urine anion gap is positive. I think that's, 25, okay? Which suggests that the patient does have a renal tubular acidosis. All right. So here's an important thing to think about, and why I made a point about this patient having DKA. One of the pitfalls, there are many pitfalls with the urinary anion gap, but one of the pitfalls with the urinary anion gap is that it may actually underestimate ammonium excretion if there are non-reabsorbable anions in the urine, such as keto acids, okay? And we'll talk about that in another case, okay? So there's another way that you can assess urinary ammonium excretion as a double check to make sure that your urinary anion gap isn't messing with your mind. And that's something called a urinary osmolar gap. It's a little bit more complicated than a urinary anion gap, but if you're familiar with calculating a serum osmolar gap, you can do this, all right? The difference, it's very similar to a serum osmolar gap. The only difference is that in comparison to the serum osmolar gap, we also use potassium in the urinary anion gap. Remember, in the serum osmolar gap, we don't use potassium. In the urinary anion gap, we do use potassium. You also have to measure a urinary urea nitrogen. Remember, in your serum osmolar gap, you have that data as well. And we also need to measure glucose if it's positive on a dipstick in the urine, okay? So a urinary osmolar gap, okay? What do I do with this? All right, so what do you do? What you get in addition to those things is a measured urinary osmolality, similar to what you do when you're calculating a serum osmolar gap, and then you have to calculate your urinary osmolality, okay? So here's the formula. You take 2 times the positive charges in the urine, sodium plus potassium, and just like you do for the serum osmolality calculation, you divide the urinary urea by 2.8, and you also divide the glucose by 18, exactly like what you do for a serum osmolar gap, okay? So here are the values. I'm not gonna go through all the math, but this patient's measured osmolality was 343. When you plug all these things into the formula, you get a calculated value of 330, okay? Then you subtract that, and your value is 13, okay? Subtract that from that, okay? What does that mean? Well, half of this is ammonium, and half of it is the accompanying anion that comes along with this ammonium, okay? So what does that mean? Well, if you have a urinary osmolar gap that is less than 150, that suggests impaired renal ammonia excretion. This patient's urinary osmolar gap was 13, so it's much, much lower than 150, telling you that the patient really does have impaired ammonia production, okay? All right, so the hypokalemia workup so far tells us that this patient has renal potassium loss. The normal anion gap metabolic workup, metabolic acidosis workup tells us that the patient has impaired ammonium excretion. What is the diagnosis? Is it RTA, hypokalemic periodic paralysis, or laxative abuse? Any guesses? All right, it's a kidney problem, right? The kidney's getting rid of potassium when it shouldn't be. You're losing potassium when your potassium is low. You want the kidney to hold on to as much potassium as possible. And you're also seeing a state in which you are having impaired ammonium excretion. And the answer to this question is a distal RTA, okay? All right, let's move on to case number 3, okay? So this is another similar case of a 21-year-old woman with hypokalemic periodic paralysis. She's admitted for generalized weakness. 135, potassium is 2, chlorides 118, bicarbs 12, low bicarb, calculate the anion gap. You get 5, so a normal anion gap metabolic acidosis. Look at her BUN, 1.4, that's not an error. And her creatinine is 0.8. Glucose is 112, okay? Her blood gas shows a low pH and a PCO2 that's 25, consistent with a metabolic acidosis, okay? Here are her urine labs. Her pH is a little bit high, so again, would fit a type 1 RTA. When you check her urinary anion gap, as you should with a normal anion gap metabolic acidosis, the positives outweigh the negatives, right? 17 plus 5 is 22, more than 7.5, so she has a positive urinary NI gap. Okay? She has hypokalemia and, again, a normal anion gap metabolic acidosis. This case is tricky, though, okay, because it's not due to an RTA and it's not due to diarrhea. But there is a certain type of poisoning that can give you this picture. And I'll give you some choices here. Ethylene glycol, isopropanol, toluene, or salicylates. Anyone want to venture a guess? Has anyone seen this before? I hear salicylates. Anyone else? Okay. This is a tough one. This is toluene. Okay? Toluene. All right. So the trick here with toluene is that it gives you two different acid-base states. You can have an initial high anion gap metabolic acidosis. Okay? That's because toluene is metabolized to something called hippuric acid, which is an anion which will contribute an acid, giving you a metabolic acidosis. But this anion here contributes to a high anion gap. So early in the toxicity, you can have a high anion gap metabolic acidosis. Okay? But what happens shortly after all of this occurs is that this hippuric acid is actually freely filtered. This is my terrible drawing of a glomerulus with a tubule. This hippuric acid is freely filtered by the glomerulus, and because it is negatively charged, it can bind to things like potassium and sodium. Okay? So when that happens, patients can develop hypokalemia. Because of the natriuresis, they can develop hypovolemia. And because of the contribution of the proton, they develop a normal anion gap metabolic acidosis once the hippuric acid has left the system. Because there's so much sodium and potassium that is coming out of the urine because it's binding to this anion hippuric acid, this is the reason why you have a positive urine anion gap. And in this case, it would be very important for you to do a urinary osmolar gap to confirm that the patient really does actually have adequate ammonium production and excretion. But I'm not going to go through that at this point. We're just going to move on from that. Okay? So this can be a tricky one to diagnose because it looks very much like a type 1 RTA. Okay? So what is toluene? It's an organic solvent. It's very commonly found in paint thinners, gas, and glue, etc. Okay? It's a very powerful CNS depressant. That's why people abuse it. It can cause asphyxia, arrhythmias, seizures, and with prolonged use, I'm sure you've heard about, can cause severe cognitive impairment. Okay? The effects of toluene come on in seconds, and the effects last about an hour, so a lot of people will have repeat exposures, taking multiple hits of toluene, and the elimination is about 20 to 45% in the lung, and the remainder is via the kidney, okay? So what are the ways that people take in toluene? Sniffing, huffing, and bagging, and this is one of my favorite scenes in any movie ever, and this is from Airplane. Do you guys remember this when he says, "Looks like I picked the wrong week to stop sniffing glue"? Okay? So sniffing glue is one thing, okay? Huffing is another, and this is a guy who went with gold paint, and you basically just put paint on a rag, and you put it up to your mouth and your nose, and you huff it that way, and you get the nice face paint sign. And then finally, there's bagging, where some kids will actually just spray paint into a bag and inhale it that way, okay? So these are some of the ways that people take in toluene, okay? The treatment with toluene poisoning is to restore the blood volume and replace potassium as necessary. A lot of times people get hypophosphatemic, so you replace that as well. But it may take several days before you can actually clear all of the toluene out of the system because of its high lipid solubility, so there can be some prolonged effects here in these patients. Now, even though it looks like an RTA, it really is not an RTA because the kidneys are actually making plenty of ammonium. It's just not enough to get rid of all that acid. And that RTA will usually resolve after stopping the toluene. Okay? So it's a very challenging diagnosis to make. It mimics type 1 RTA, and it's, again, very hard to make this diagnosis. Some of the clues are if you have a rash. Some people, when they sniff glue, because of the alcohol and other things that are in it, will cause drying out of that area of the face, and you can have this thing called a glue sniffer's rash. Or you could have this guy who looks very happy in the ER, hooked up to oxygen with blue paint all over his face. Okay, so if you get lucky enough to find a patient that way, you shouldn't miss this diagnosis. Okay, the other key points is that you have to go through the work up here completely when you have this normal anion gap metabolic acidosis, and if things don't make sense with the urinary anion gap and how the patient is presenting, remember that a urinary osmolar gap is another test you can do. Okay. All right. Next case. All right, this is a good one. Actually, I think all of these are good, but I really like this one. 31-year-old woman seen in the emergency room. She's obtunded, all right? Sodium's 147, potassium's up 5.7, chloride 120, bicarb is 9. So you add that up, that's 29 minus 47 is 18, I believe. So her anion gap is elevated, kidney function's normal, glucose is normal. Blood gas consistent with metabolic acidosis, pH is low, 7.25, base excess is negative 19, and here we go, lactate is 17. What is her main acid-base disorder? I think it's pretty clear she has a high anion gap metabolic acidosis, and at least based off of the blood gas, this could be due to lactic acid, okay? The problem here in this patient is that she's not in shock. Her exam was pretty much unremarkable other than being obtunded. And there was no other readily apparent cause of lactic acidosis, no drugs, no nothing, okay? All right. When they checked their serum lactate, it was 1.4, but her blood gas lactate was 8, okay? This might be ringing some bells for folks, okay? So since her serum lactate is normal, what is the cause of the high anion gap acidosis? All right, so I'm just gonna go through this real briefly, okay? This is medical school stuff, mud piles, right? Methanol, uremia, usually this is with creatinines that are more than 4 or so. Diabetic ketoacidosis, pyraldehyde, which isn't available in this country, INH, lactic acidosis, ethylene glycol, and salicylates, okay? So with a mud piles, based mnemonic for this. The common things that you're gonna see are methanol and ethylene glycol, and the screening test for this is a serum osmolality. For DKA and other types of ketoacidoses, check the urine for ketones. Lactic acidosis, check a lactate, and then salicylates, do a tox screen, okay? INH and pyraldehyde are not that common. I've never seen it. And then uremia, you already can figure that out if the creatinine's up on the chemistry panel, okay? So going back to our patient, doing some of these tests, the lactate on the serum was 1.4, serum osmolality was 378, okay? That's measured, and when you calculate the osmolality using that formula, it was 306. So clearly she has a high osmolar gap of 72. Along those lines, her ketones and her salicylate was negative, okay? Both of those were negative, all right? So what's the diagnosis? Ethylene glycol poisoning, okay? Her ethylene glycol was 380. And this is one of the things that I get most excited about when I teach medical students, and it's talking about the osmolar gap, as maybe you can tell. This is the standard osmolar gap calculation, or osmolality calculation that we use. But if you have an ethylene glycol level, you can also throw that into the formula and see if there are other toxic alcohols or even standard alcohol in the system. So if we go through this patient's case and we plug in all of her lab values, plus her ethylene glycol level of 380 divided by the molecular weight of ethylene glycol, divided by 10, the molecular weight is 62, and you have to correct that by 10. So anyway, take that, divided by 6.2. Now her calculated osmolality is 367, her measured osmolality is 378, and now her osmolar gap is normal, which tells you that there's nothing else in the system and her methanol level should be undetectable, and that's exactly what it was, okay? So this is a case of a woman who had a high lactate on her blood gas, but a normal lactate in the serum, who ended up having ethylene glycol poisoning, okay? So it's very important to go through the workup of these acidotic problems very closely, okay? So why the heck does this happen, okay? So at the time, so at one point, her lactate on her blood gas was 17. And what happens with ethylene glycol is that it gets metabolized, okay, to glycoaldehyde and glycolate and glyoxylate and oxalate, okay? But the problem here and the reason why this happens is that the glycolate looks a lot like lactate, okay? This is glycolate, which is a byproduct of ethylene glycol metabolism, looks a lot like lactate. And actually, the blood gas analyzer is measuring the glycolate thinking that it's lactate, okay? So this is why the patient had a high lactic acid on the blood gas, but a normal lactic acid on the serum test, okay? So this is ethylene glycol poisoning that is associated with a high lactate gap, and it's something that you really should keep in mind whenever you have a patient who has a high lactic acid level on a blood gas. Just remember that that could be a false positive, and the patient could actually have ethylene glycol poisoning, okay? The diagnosis could have easily been missed unless people were very astute to the patient's clinical presentation and also confirming the high lactic acid on the blood gas by checking it on the serum, okay? So I strongly suggest that you always confirm that with a serum lactic acid level, okay? And just to reiterate the point that a complete workup of a high anion gap metabolic acidosis is very, very important. Okay. All right, this is another fun case. This is a very hard one, okay? This is a 40-year-old man seen in the clinic after an episode of pancreatitis. Sodium's 141, potassium's 3.3, chloride 103, bicarb is 9, 9 plus 3 is 12, minus 41 is 29. So a high anion gap metabolic acidosis, okay? Creatinine's up a little bit, 1.7, glucose 112, okay? Since his pancreatitis, so he's just coming in for a follow-up visit, and those were his labs on that day, actually. But when talking to him, he said he was feeling better, but his appetite was poor, he didn't feel well, and he had some abdominal pain. He's a complicated patient with a lot of medical problems, including congenital nephrogenic diabetes insipidus, familial polycythemia, gout. He also had RA, obstructive uropathy, and recurrent pancreatitis. This was a very, very sick person at 40, okay? These are a list of his medications, including probenecid, amiloride, and thiazide, doxazosin, nitrofurantoin, okay, all these things, which aren't necessarily important. On exam, he's afebrile. Lying blood pressure is 118 over 72, heart rate's 114. Standing, his blood pressure drops by about 9 systolic, but he becomes a little bit tachycardic to 133. He's volume depleted with a jugular venous pulse that's 2 centimeters below the sternal angle, and he has 2+ edema, okay? All right, so remember, high anion gap metabolic acidosis is confirmed by the low pH, okay? And what acid-base disorders does he have? I'm gonna skip that and just tell you that he has a high anion gap acidosis and a mild respiratory alkalosis, okay? So mud piles-based workup should include a serum osmolality, which you check here, 307, and you calculate his osmolality, it's 298, and here it's only 9, which is a normal osmolar gap. So there's no evidence of ethylene glycol or methanol poisoning. The other aspects of the workup should include a lactate, which was normal. His ketones were negative. Alcohol was negative, which is what you would expect. Remember, alcohol does not give you a metabolic acidosis. Tests for toxic alcohols, including ethylene glycol, were negative, which is not surprising since he did not have a high osmolar gap. His acetaminophen level was 38, and his salicylates were negative, okay? So none of this has been helpful, right? There's no lactic acidosis. There's no poisoning that we know about. There's no ketones, okay? What is going on here? So what's the diagnosis? Is it lactic acidosis, ethylene glycol poisoning, pyroglutamic acidosis, or salicylate? This is a really hard one. And by saying it's really hard, you should be guessing three. Pyroglutamic acidosis, okay? So acetaminophen metabolism, there's three ways that Tylenol acetaminophen can be metabolized. I don't know if I just violated a disclosure or something. Acetaminophen, okay? It can be glucuronidated, okay? Or it can be sulfated, but there is some that goes through the cytochrome P450 system, which ultimately leads to glutathione depletion, okay? So how the heck does that happen? There we go. How the heck? Oh, my heck. All right. So when you have acetaminophen go through the glutathione pathway, what happens is it depletes glutathione, okay? And this is very complicated, so I'm just going to show you the highlights. When you deplete glutathione here, this releases this inhibition here of this enzyme so that this enzyme keeps going. It's ramped up because nothing's stopping it. And so when that happens, you have increased amounts of this thing here, all right? And when you have increased amounts of that and no glutathione for it to be converted through this pathway, it actually shuttles this way here. All right, and the names really aren't that important. I'm just showing it to you for simplicity here. Okay, so you release inhibition here. You have high levels of this. Since you can't go through this pathway, this has to come in this way. Okay, so you get high levels of 5-oxaproline, which is also called pyroglutamic acid. When you have high levels of this, these accumulate here because there's this enzyme here is the rate-limiting step, which leads to very high levels of oxaproline, okay? So when this patient's urine pyroglutamic acid was measured, it's also called 5-oxaproline, it was more than 40,000, which a normal is less than 70, okay? So there are other things that can cause pyroglutamic acidosis, and those include sepsis, inherited disorders, and pregnancy and malnutrition. So there are some things that can cause this apart from acetaminophen. So how do they present? They also have a high anion gap metabolic acidosis. Since it's excreted in the urinary anion gap can be positive because it will bind to things like sodium and potassium, making that anion gap positive. The treatment is largely supportive, and that's to stop the Tylenol. Usually there's something else going on, and in this patient, the patient did have bacteremia. Some people have used dialysis in case reports to get rid of the pyroglutamic acid, but it's not clear that that makes a significant effect. And N-acetylcysteine has a theoretical benefit that has been reported in some case reports, but not all have found that NAC really makes a big difference in these patients. Okay? So I put this case in here because it really tells you the limitations of the mud piles mnemonic. And this is one that I like. It's called cute dimples, okay? And so what does it stand for? Cyanide and citrate, okay? Cyanide, the most common exposure that you might see this in is in house fires or warehouse fires, okay? Cyanide poisoning. Citrate is largely seen in our CRRT patients when we give them citrate anticoagulation. Uremia is here. Toluene is here as well because remember, very early on, you can have a high anion gap acidosis. We retain ethylene glycol. We keep diabetic ketoacidosis. INH and iron fit here, methanol. And then the P is very fun because it includes pyroglutamic acid and propylene glycol as well as peraldehyde. Now, propylene glycol does not cause the high anion gap by itself. It's the metabolite that gets propylene glycol gets metabolized to D-lactate, okay? So D-lactic acidosis from propylene glycol. Where you might see this is in the ICU. Patients who are receiving long-term Ativan intravenously, that the diluent in the Ativan contains propylene glycol. So you might have some ICU patients who have an unexplained high anion gap acidosis. If they're on Ativan, think about propylene glycol and D-lactic acidosis. The trouble with that is getting a lab to measure D-lactate, and I think the only place is the Mayo Clinic. Okay. Lactic acid is also in this mnemonic, both the D and L forms. Ethanol, even though I told you that ethanol does not cause a high anion gap metabolic acidosis, that is acutely, but if you have chronic ketoacidosis from that, then you can have a high anion gap. And then finally, salicylates, starvation, ketoacidosis, and sodium thiosulfate, which is important for us as nephrologists because sometimes we use this to treat patients who have calciphylaxis, okay? So this, to me, is a more complete mnemonic, and it may be hard to remember, but if you Google cute dimples, well, actually, I don't know what you'll find when you Google cute dimples. So maybe just disregard that. You might get, well, just don't do it at work. All right. Probably last case. Okay. This is a fun one, too. All right. I call this one a sticky situation. This is a 29-year-old Hispanic woman who came to the ER with burning pain in her feet, and the ER calls and says, we were about to send her home, but then her labs came back. And then we said, why did you check her labs? Okay, 141, 3.9, chloride 139. Okay, chloride 139, bicarb 25, kidney function normal. So what's weird? The chloride, right? Is that possible? Maybe, okay. So we're going to talk about that, all right? So, you know, the first thing you do is you tell them, well, repeat it, okay? And so you repeat it, and it's still high, all right? Here's her blood gas. They got it, even though there's no evidence of an acid-base abnormality, and her ABG was completely normal, and her base excess was very, very small. Okay, so normal blood gas, all right? So she has hyperchloremia and a negative anion gap, which in this case go hand in hand. She underwent an extensive workup, CBC, LFTs, FOS, manganese, heavy metals, ceruloplasmin, blah, 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 arsenic, thallium, blah, 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 all this stuff, okay? Na, T, all negative, all right? Okay? 3 years later, I'm telling this story a little bit different than it actually happened, but I'm doing this to give you maybe a clue as to what the diagnosis is. 3 years later, she had spastic diplegia. She had distal neuropathic pain and sensory loss. And she walked with a stiff-legged antalgic gait using a clawed cane. Okay? So all this means that she has some nerve problems, right? Okay. So she's got hyperchloremia, a negative anion gap, and irreversible neurotoxicity. What is the diagnosis? 1, hyperchloremia, 2, myeloma, 3, bromide, 4, lupus. I think someone might have seen this before. Anyone have a clue? It's a fun one, so guess what the answer is? Bromide. Bromism, okay? So you may think, I mean, bromism was kind of a thing in the past, right? And I'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. But we saw another case of a young man who was playing video games all night, pounding, just going to town on Mountain Dews, and his chloride was very high. And it turns out that Mountain Dew and other soft drinks can have brominated vegetable oil. Okay, so this can be something you might see at one point. Okay. This is an image from NEJM showing a condition that has now become one of my favorite words, and that's called bromoderma, okay, where you get these nasty skin lesions here. And again, brominated vegetable oil is in red ruby squirt, okay? So it's in some drinks that are commonly consumed in the United States, okay? And it turns out that, you know, back in her initial diagnosis, her serum bromide level when it was checked was 170 milligrams per deciliter, which turns out to be 21 millimoles or milliequivalents per liter, which is extremely high. Okay. I'm not sure how this was done, but Dr. Gregory at the university measured the chloride by a chlorometer, and I don't even know where you find this anymore, but he measured the chloride and it was actually normal, 107. So the chloride was completely normal, and the only reason why the serum chloride on the chemistry machine was high was because it was measuring both chloride as well as bromide. Okay? And why does it do that? Because bromide looks a lot like chloride. It sits right under chloride under the periodic on the periodic table. Okay? All right. So bromide was used in the past as an anticonvulsant and sedative. Okay? It leads to chronic neurotoxicity because it substitutes for chloride in nerves, but I believe it can't get out once it's in there. And it does the same thing in the kidney. It substitutes for chloride, and so when it's filtered by the kidney, whatever chloride would have been reabsorbed, the same thing will happen with bromide. Any filtered bromide will be reabsorbed by the kidney, which makes it incredibly difficult to get rid of. Okay. So there are some therapeutic levels. 10 to 50 gives you sedation, which may be the intended therapeutic benefit. Okay, but if you have levels that are higher, 75 to 150, these were targets in the past for seizure control. But if you get much higher levels, such as more than 150, that can lead to debilitating toxicity. And remember, our patient's level was 170. Values more than 300 are often fatal. Okay, so where the heck was this coming from? So she was from Mexico. She was in the U.S. for 3 years. She was a clean liver. She takes this herbal supplement called maca. She worked in a furniture factory gluing styrofoam chair seats. She did not use protective equipment. And she said another worker started walking funny. Okay. So what is maca? I have no idea, but it has 1 to 2 milligrams of bromide per capsule. And so the idea was, well, maybe that's it. But we thought, well, maybe, well, not me. This is Dr. Gregory's case, so I shouldn't take credit. He thought, is this an occupational exposure? And what ultimately was determined was that the solvent that she was using in the glue contained 1-bromopropane, okay? And other workers had also developed elevated bromide levels, okay? So 1-bromopropane is a solvent that was introduced into these glues to replace chlorofluorocarbons, or CFCs. And these were banned because they deplete the ozone, obviously. They're also used in dry cleaning. At least the bromopropane is used in dry cleaning applications, okay? But it's also a carcinogen, all right? So ultimately, it was thought that this patient had bromism from the 1-bromopropane that was in the glue that she was using to glue the styrofoam seats to the furniture. All right, I think we'll just wrap it up there. So in summary, we've gone through a lot of weird cases, and I hope that you remember some things that we talk about in terms of the urinary anion gap. Urinary osmolar gap is maybe something you haven't heard about or even thought about in a long time, but it can provide some helpful information, particularly in cases of toluene exposure or other conditions that give you high anions that might be filtered by the kidney and excreted. I hope that you remember some of these potassium cutoffs that I suggested in the first 3 cases. I spent 3 cases talking on hypokalemia and metabolic acidosis, which I think is probably one of the more common situations that you'll come across. So if you have a patient with hypokalemia, you can use those cutoffs to determine if a patient really does have renal potassium wasting. Okay. Finally, don't Google cute dimples at work, but do it at home. But try to remember that, because mud piles does not work for every case. And there are even more things that cause a high anion gap metabolic acidosis that I could fit into this mnemonic. The serum osmolar gap is something that you shouldn't forget when you're working up patients. And then, I think we've seen several cases of this now at the university where you have a lactate gap, which is really the presenting feature of an ethylene glycol poisoning. So I can't encourage you enough that if you have a high lactate on a blood gas, please, please confirm that with a serum lactate, because if that's normal, you're probably dealing with ethylene glycol. And obviously the problem with missing that is you wouldn't be making the right diagnosis and you wouldn't be treating them with fomepizole or, very unlikely, alcohol, okay? So with that, I will conclude and take any questions. Thanks for having me again. It's been nice to come back here. Thanks.
Just as a reminder, years ago, there was a product called Bromo Seltzer.
Thank you. Has anyone seen bromism? Okay.
My question is also on the bromine patient. If she had used a protective device like a mask or something like that, would that have prevented the toxicity?
We believe so, yeah. Yeah, unfortunately, I think the employer either didn't know or didn't care and didn't do enough education. Yep. Yes, sir. Serum, oh, you mean the serum potassiums? Yeah. Why did they live? Because they received great care at the University of Utah. No, I mean, I see your point. You know, that one woman who had the potassium less than 1.6, I mean, that was a clear shocker. I think we were all very surprised that she was alive. Probably because of her age. You know, if that happens to an older person with other comorbidities, they probably don't survive that. But obviously the University of Utah was the reason why. I'm having fun. Okay, thank you.
Okay, our last speaker will be discussing the workup of patients with kidney stones. So are kidney stones a urologic disorder or a medical disorder? I'm going to present the thought that kidney stone disease may actually be a medical disorder and that patients with recurrent stones should undergo a metabolic evaluation to see what is the cause of their stones and what kind of treatment to give. And so Dr. Jenczyk from the University of Utah Nephrology Department will enlighten us on this topic.